Hi, I'm Adrienne Hill. Bye, bye, bye. How do we do it and why? This is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of June 14th, 2013. On today's show, we're talking about what we spend our money on, what we save it for, and who we give it to. And we want to start the show with that giving part, because we Americans, we give pretty generously. We give more to charity per capita than any other developed nation. In 2011, we gave $200 billion. But all that money isn't always going where we think it is or where we want it to be. The Tampa Bay Times and the Center for Investigative Reporting have released a list of America's worst charities. 50 organizations that raised billions of dollars but gave hardly any of it to the people who need it. In some cases, these charities gave no money at all. Instead, much of the money went to pay fundraising firms, those people who bombard us with calls at dinner time and direct mail. Kendall Taggart is a data reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting and is with us now. Hi, Kendall.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. So the amount of money that you all found going to people in need from some of these charities is shockingly small. What's going on?
Well, I think for a lot of these groups that are using outside fundraisers, it's an easy way to cover their own salaries, and there's very little regulation making sure that they follow through on the promises that they've made to donors.
And it looks like some of these charities are providing absolutely no cash assistance to the causes they're supposed to support. So what kind of help are they providing?
Some of them are providing what's called gifts in kind, so that could be something like medical supplies that they're shipping overseas. The problem is that there's no way to verify the value of those goods, so they can be used to inflate a charity's both revenue on the books and also what it looks like they're doing in terms of programs.
One of the stories that stood out to me from your series was about a woman who'd reached out to a fund for help with her husband was dying with cancer, and she reached out for a fund and asked for help.
Yeah, she had reached out to an organization called Cancer Fund of America looking for financial assistance. And what she got in the mail was pretty much worthless goods. She told us that it felt like a slap in the face, and she just threw it in the trash.
What'd she get?
I think her husband had lung cancer, and when she received stuff from them, it was only paper plates, cups, napkins, and kids' toys. And she's a 67-year-old Knoxville, Tennessee resident who couldn't really make good use of that.
Wow. So, Kendall, I'm interested just in naming some names here. Who wound up on your worst charity list?
The top of our list is an organization called Kids Wish Network. They operate out of a metal warehouse in Holiday, Florida. And over the past decade, they've raised millions of dollars. Of that, about 80%, $110 million, has gone to professional solicitors. $4.8 million has gone to the charity's founder and his consulting firm. And only 3 cents of every dollar that they've raised has actually been spent directly on helping kids.
So what do people who are sending money to Kids Wish Network think they're sending it for?
They believe they're helping grant the wishes of terminally ill children.
And it sounds like the Make-A-Wish Foundation, right? I mean, it seemed like lots of these worst charities have names that are very similar to other charities.
Right. Most of the causes are popular causes that appeal to donors and may sound like a more well-known group.
So how can givers, how can people who want to be generous make sure they're sending their money to good places instead of places that are just looking to take a salary?
There are resources online to research whether or not the charity is doing what you think it is with your money. Some basic steps that people can take if they get a phone call at home is to find out exactly who's calling, where their donation will go, what they'll do with your money, and if you get a call, know that there's a cost and that they, if you ask, need to tell you what that cost is, whether the telemarketer is going to take 80, 90 cents or that kind of thing.
What's the question you'd ask in that case?
How much of my donation is going to go to the charity versus to your professional firm?
And they have to answer that?
They do if they're asked. They don't have to tell you if you don't ask.
Any other advice for folks who are looking to do the right thing?
There are definitely watchdog groups out there that say if you get a call, you should hang up and give directly, that's the best way to know that your money's going where you want it to go.
Kendall Taggart from the Center for Investigative Reporting, thanks so much.
Great, thank you. Appreciate it.
We've got the list of the 50 worst charities they identified on our website, marketplacemoney.org. Donating money is one way to spend thoughtfully, but there are a lot of other ways to show financial support for causes you believe in. Everything from buying organic foods to investing in socially responsible companies to only shopping for clothes made in the U.S. Well, we asked Marketplace listeners about their own mindful consumption, and we got a ton of responses about putting your money where your morals are. On Facebook, Chris wrote to say, "I am honestly very mindful to spend the least amount for the product sufficient for my needs." And Carlos wrote, "I became a vegetarian 4 years ago. Good for health, good for animals, good for the planet." Well, we've asked two of our other Facebook friends to join us on the program today. Leslie in Bergen County, New Jersey. Hi, Leslie.
Hello there.
And Kelly in Valley Grove, West Virginia. Welcome to you both.
Hello. Thank you.
So, Leslie, I want to start with you. Why do you think of yourself as a mindful consumer? What does that mean to you?
For me, it's about having an awareness about everything that's involved along the chain of manufacturing any given product and knowing the origins and where it started, thinking backwards to where it all began. And so that does impact me.
And Kelly, what about you? What's it mean that you think of yourself as a mindful consumer?
Similar to what Leslie had said. Additionally, packaging is an important part of the piece. Also, transportation, so buying as locally as possible.
Now, buying things like this can cost more. I know from personal experience, it can be hard at the grocery store to choose one thing over another when one is so much more expensive. Leslie, how does that affect you?
It is definitely an impact. I go through kind of, a Sybil multiple personality experience every time I go to the supermarket, in which one second I'm like, well, I grew up on conventional foods. It doesn't matter. And then I'm like, yeah, but the pesticides weren't as bad back then. But it's so much more expensive. And my daughter, just stuffs down the blueberries nonstop. And so it's complicated. And, honestly, I'm sporadic. I do organic sometimes, and then other times I'm feeling, go for what I can feel like, works in my pocketbook. So it's complicated.
And what about you, Kelly? How does cost factor in for you?
Cost is certainly a significant factor. I have three small children. I am a stay-at-home mom primarily. I work very part-time, and my husband works a nonprofit. So cost is absolutely an issue. But, we try to play that same game where I feel my husband tells me that I have multiple shopping personalities sometimes. And we go back and forth all the time as to whether or not it's worth it to purchase sweatshop-free clothing for our children. And, sometimes we'll settle on yes, and occasionally, more often, we settle on just purchasing used clothing for our children. Just there are many different things. It's kind of a fluid situation.
Now, you've mentioned your community a couple times, Kelly. Why is that such an important part of how you spend your money?
We actually lived in northern New Jersey for a number of years and moved back to West Virginia for very specific reasons. It has not been an easy transition all the time. There are a lot of things that we left behind, including access to maybe more products that were in line with our way of thinking. But now we live in a small town. We're able to connect with other people in our community. We're able to exchange goods and services. And there's certainly a cost of living issue. We made a decision to move away from a place that was a big city to a smaller town because of the cost benefits of a lower cost of living.
And so was that move in and of itself an example of mindful consumption, do you think?
Absolutely, yes.
One more thing that came up on our Facebook page a lot and that I think about myself is mindful consumption as not buying. Is that something that for you, Leslie, factors in sometimes?
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing more satisfying than not going out to lunch at my office and, having packed. I think about that all the time, like for sure, food-wise, but also clothing-wise. I know Kelly mentioned buying used. I'm a huge fan of that. I'm also a huge fan of hand-me-downs. I mean, for my child, for me, for my husband. I mean, and we revel in it, I mean, it's just kind of, we have all these fun nicknames like a sand me down from my friend Sandy and a Dan me down from my sister Danielle. I'm cognizant of it all the time. I'm cognizant of what I can reduce and what I can reuse and recycle, and not just recycle in the way of recycling plastic or glass, or it's recycling clothing, it's recycling books. It's about money, and it's about sharing, and it is about community. So
one thing that struck me is I recently had a baby. He's 7 months old, and I know you guys are both moms, and I find it really hard to find the time to be a mindful consumer,
yes.
Maybe the way I did before.
Yes, I think that that's huge. In the beginning, everything with my daughter was organic. Everything was, and of course, it's gifting, right? Everybody's gifted you the soft organic cotton blankets, and you're like, this is what should have in her skin forever. And then reality comes, and you work, 8:30 to 6, and then Children's Place is sending you a coupon for $3.99 and free shipping, and what's a girl to do, right? So I think it's, you do make choices based on convenience. For me, I do. And I feel a little pangs of guilt, but I also, it's sort of my reality, so.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I think at certain points, my oldest is 7.5, and there have been points where I've worked full-time, part-time, and not at all. But I think as a parent, it's not beneficial to you, your child, your family to beat yourself up over what you can and can't do with the time that you have.
Just do the best you can.
That's true.
Kelly and Leslie, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Leslie and Kelly contacted us on Facebook, and you can too if you want to weigh in on the conversation about mindful consumption, or you can send us a message at marketplacemoney.org. Month, we get a new set of unemployment numbers, more information on who's working and what jobs and who isn't, which is still about 11 million of us. And buried in that data is another number, part-time workers who'd rather have full-time jobs. There are nearly 8 million of those workers out there, and a lot of them are younger. They're millennials. Reporter Sarah Gardner has been tracking young part-timers for Marketplace's Consume series, and she's with us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Adrian.
So millennials, given their job status, how do they fit in the consumer economy right now?
Well, I think they would like to be more active participants in the consumer economy if they could be. But because of what's happening with jobs and wages, they are not. I mean, the latest numbers show that about 40% of them are, quote unquote, underemployed.
Okay.
And I think some of that includes, these part-time jobs, these contract jobs, temp jobs, one-time gigs that they're taking to make things work. But the problem with that kind of work, as you and I know, is that it's not very stable and it doesn't give you a lot of confidence to buy things or big ticket items in the consumer economy.
Right. You can't plan for the future. You can't figure out if you can buy a car or not. So tell me a little bit about the 20-some-year-olds you talked to. What did they tell you about their experience and where they were?
Yeah, it was really interesting to talk to some of these people because personally I'm interested in it. I have a 22-year-old,
oh.
So I was concerned about, where this generation is going.
Right.
I talked to one woman who was from Athens, Georgia. She's 26. Her name is Rachel Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
And she is a college grad. And she described her quote-unquote career to me as a patchwork quilt of jobs.
What kind of jobs is she doing?
She is waitressing.
Uh-huh.
She is doing online marketing for the restaurant she waitresses at. She is doing some freelance journalism. And she is also, doing sort of one-offs, like she told me prosthetic breast sales. She made a couple $100 from,
wow.
from doing that. The problem is last year that added up to about $28,000.
Okay.
And she says she's frustrated.
I never thought that I would have so many concerns about just like how to have the basic things that I want. Because I'm not a super materialistic person. I don't want to have a lot of really fancy technology or a really swanky car. Like, I need to get my computer fixed. That's a $200 repair. That's a pretty big financial hardship for me at this point because I'm basically breaking even from month to month.
And so this sounds like a woman who's not saving. I mean, is that right?
Right. She told me, frankly, I think so far she's saved a little under $700.
And is that common for this generation?
Well, there was a survey done recently by Wells Fargo that showed that half of millennials are saving for retirement and half of them say they are not. Whether they can't or just aren't, we don't know. The problem is we don't know how much they're saving. But of course, you know, a lot of them aren't making that much to begin with. Another person I talked to was a young woman in Raleigh, North Carolina. Her name is Sibel Yaman. Mm-hmm. She's 25. She is another college grad who's been, you know, surviving so far on part-time and temp work. She just got a full-time job.
Congratulations, Sibel.
Right. But she has big ambitions. She wants to own her own PR firm one day. And she said to me that she's just had a lot of trouble saving.
When I first graduated, I was hoping to be able to have a 401k set up. I was ready to be able to start planning buying a house. And once I was unemployed and once I was, you know, really not sure how I was going to pay for groceries, that changed. It's really, really hard for me to adjust to being able to look farther than a month ahead in terms of my finances.
So someone, if you're looking a month ahead, you know, you're not purchasing big ticket items. You're not making big commitments in the consumer economy.
They're not doing things like purchasing cars or thinking about buying houses or apartments.
Right.
Which also means they have less debt, which is a good thing, right?
Right. That's right. There are two sides to this. You know, when I talked to Sibel, she told me that at one point she got into a lot of credit card debt and she paid it off and tore up her credit cards. So there is less debt, except for student loan debt, by the way. That's going up, of course. But the flip side of that is that they don't have the money to buy those things. So, you know, that's less net worth.
Now, you mentioned your own daughter, Sarah. What do you see with her situation?
Well, I thought this was funny. I mean, what everyone's wondering is this generation of young people going to turn out to be very, very frugal, as frugal as, say, my dad's generation, which, you know, he grew up during the Great Depression. And I was thinking the other day that my daughter is beginning to remind me a bit of my father.
How so? What's she doing?
She called me the other day and was complaining that she couldn't log into my Netflix account. And I was like, you know, just get your own Netflix account. You're an adult now. You know, you have a job. It's not that much. What is it, like?
Nine bucks a month, yeah.
$9 a month. And she said, Mom, I'm not going to do that. That's way too expensive. So she's Netflix poor at this point.
Do you worry about your daughter?
I do. And I think that anybody who has kids, quote unquote, my daughter's age, if they're not worried, they're not being fully honest, because it does seem to some of us like this isn't just some sort of cyclical downturn. I mean, I think the worry is, you know, that there is something structural happening here. And, you know, I would love for her not to worry about, you know, paying for her own Netflix account. She could pay for mine, too.
Marketplace reporter Sarah Gardner covers sustainability issues. You can find her report on part-time workers for Marketplace's Consume series on our website, marketplace.org. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks a lot, Adrian.
Not every millennial with an unpredictable work week feels pessimistic about the future. Take Dave McCullough. He's 28. He lives in San Diego. He was laid off from his full-time job a couple months ago and has been going it alone as a freelancer ever since. Dave is part of our Public Insight Network, and he responded to one of our recent queries about job security. Hey, Dave.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So tell me about your freelance work. What do you do?
So I took a leap and I started my own public relations, communications, and digital services firm.
And how's it going?
So far, so good. You know, at first I was absolutely scared. I wasn't sure if this was going to be a long-term solution, but already things are just coming together. I picked up a number of great clients. I just received my first check today from one of them.
Wait, your very first check came in the mail today?
Yep, sure did.
How'd that feel?
As soon as I opened the mailbox, I just did this huge jump for joy. Like, it's finally here. It's really working. Oh, my gosh, I can live.
What are you going to do with that money?
Just like many other people, I've got a mortgage to pay. I've got a car payment. So it's no different than anything else, except it's going right toward the basic necessities.
What do you miss about the stability of your old job?
I miss sometimes the socialization. I miss being around some awesome colleagues that I used to work with on a daily basis. And I miss that camaraderie. But ultimately, the the benefits of being on your own and starting your own firm, I see as something I can't imagine, or I can't believe that I didn't do this until now.
Do you ever have days or moments where you get kind of freaked out?
Oh, every day that I wake up, I realize that if I'm not billing, I'm not making money. And ultimately, if I'm not making any money, then my lifestyle, is of which I like to become accustomed, goes out the door.
And one more question. What would you do if somebody came to you today and offered you a full-time PR job at a firm?
That would be a tough one. That would be a real tough one. You know, I'm enjoying what I'm doing so much that I would really have to sit down and think about it. I mean, there are days when I get to work from almost anywhere in the world that I would want to. And going back into an office job would be a real kind of thought-inducing challenge.
Dave McCullough, thanks so much.
Thank you, Adrian.
And now it's time to play
Work It or Not!
Yes, it's the game that tells you whether that purchase you made was a good consumer buy or a waste of money. I'm your host, Adrian Hill, and on today's show, we'd like to welcome contestant Mary Dew to the game. Hi, Mary.
Hey, Adrian. It's great to be here.
So what'd you bring with you today?
I have a fantastic black leather Prada wallet.
It's beautiful. How much did you pay for that wallet, Mary?
Back about 5 years ago, it was $375 plus tax.
So you are a public radio producer, which is not a super lucrative job. Why'd you pay $400 for a wallet?
So this actually is a sentimental purchase. I bought it with my first freelance paycheck as a journalist. So while it is something that was pretty expensive, and I don't normally buy wallets that are that expensive, I justified it to myself.
And justified it how? What did you think through?
So I sort of did a little bit of a calculation in my head, which I think a lot of us do. And I said, okay, well, this is $375, but it's really good quality. I'm going to keep it for maybe 10 years, 10 years or so, which, you know, back 5 years ago felt like a very long time away, but it's still in pretty good condition now.
So you've owned it for 5 years. Mm-hmm. You're planning to keep it another 5 years.
At least, yeah.
So let's put it in the worth it or not game. Alrighty, worth it or not? Well, the game says if you have this for another 5 years, you'll have paid about a dime a day for this Prada wallet. What do you think, Mary?
I think worth it. Totally worth it.
And what if you decide tomorrow you're going to toss it out?
I doubt that would happen because it's one of my prized possessions. But if I did toss it out, I guess 5 years worth would be 20 cents a day. I still think it's not too much money. Think about how much money you spend on food.
Fair enough. Before we go, I want to put one more thing in the worth or not machine. Yes. And this is a plastic eraser ring I got at the dollar store earlier this
week.
Quite
the investment.
Yes, it was. Yeah, totally not worth it. You too can play your own version of Worth It or Not and vote on other purchases online at marketplace.org. It's part of our Consume series, which Mary Dew produced for Marketplace's Sustainability Desk. Mary, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Adrian.
I went to the dollar store this week, and I'm an irregular dollar store shopper, but I read the news that Family Dollar wants to triple the number of stores it has around the country in a rising economy, and it just reminded me how much I like being at the dollar store. I decided to go, and I wanted to find out exactly what the draw is of the dollar store for all of us. So I met up with USC marketing professor Valerie Folks at a dollar store in Santa Monica, and we walked in. There were heaps of cantaloupes on one side of the entrance. There were stacks of of plants on the other. And I asked her about the lure of the dollar store.
Well, the lure of dollar stores is the bargain, of course, and people love to get bargains. And partly, I mean, you have to remember, too, that this is kind of tough times for a lot of people. So when you see a dollar store, it sends these signals, which is, I can shop here and I don't have to worry about going over my budget. I know I can buy lots of things. I can buy things on impulse. And it's not going to, in the end, the price is not going to really bother me. Whereas a lot of times, if you go into maybe a department store, you might see some good deals, but you're always having to, many people are having to worry about, is this going to be over my budget? So this is in some ways a freeing or a more fun experience.
Now, are there actually bargains at the dollar store?
Well, there are some bargains, but there are some things that are just the same as you might find elsewhere. So in fact, it could be that their price is slightly higher here.
Some things are definitely more expensive at the dollar store when you compare the price per unit. Diapers, for one. They're three for a dollar here. And that's more than you pay if you buy them in bulk somewhere else. But other things look like they might be deals.
Here is a box of raspberries, and this box of raspberries goes for 99 cents.
Which is a great deal,
right? It's a great deal, except...
Except
just today, I was at my local grocery store, and I found a box of raspberries for 99 cents that looked to be better quality, looked to be a little bit fresher.
Yeah, these raspberries have a sort of strange dark color.
Yes, yeah, but that's kind of what you sometimes find in a dollar store, is you find things that are not quite what you would expect, but you tolerate it because it's, after all, a bargain.
And then there's the stuff on the shelves at the dollar store that's pretty clearly not a good buy. Valerie spots this container of dollar marshmallows. And these are the hard kind of marshmallows that float in hot chocolate and are sort of powdering away. And look, I think we could say not fresh.
It looks like it's sort of old. And in fact, the expiration date is July 2013.
So you got to eat these fast.
Yes, exactly. And at bottom, it looks like the product has sort of deteriorated into some crumbs. But it might be that that's why this is offered at such a cheap price, because the store has purchased a large amount of the merchandise that's about to expire.
So not everything at the dollar store is a great deal. But there's another reason we like to shop here. It gives our brains a rest.
Our brains don't like to work that hard when we shop. Oftentimes, we think about so many purchases we make in a day, maybe 100 purchases a person makes if they go to the grocery store. And if you really stop and think about each of those purchases, it can really, you can't think about every single purchase and whether you're getting a good deal or not, and whether this price is higher than it was last time. And so it's sort of freeing to go into a place where you don't have to think very hard. You can just surrender to your impulse. So this is, a dollar store is a place for impulse purchases.
I'd never thought of my brain as that lazy when it comes to shopping, but it turns out even with big ticket items, we just don't think as hard as we could, which is why retailers often price things at $2.99, $3.99, and $4.99.
People pay attention to that first number when they're looking at a series of numbers. So, and as the numbers trail off, they tend not to pay so much attention. And so, for example, paying $500 for a phone sounds like a lot, whereas $4.99 is just below it. So the difference between $499.99 and $500 psychologically is not the same as the penny that it might seem to be.
So as somebody who thinks about this regularly, how has it changed the way you shop?
Well, in some ways, initially, I think I used to, when I first started in marketing, I used to feel sort of guilty if I didn't think very hard about each purchase. But now I realize that I'm being more efficient if I simply use what are called heuristics or rules of thumb. So I go to places where I feel like I can get a good deal, and I shop there, and I don't have to worry so much about each purchase. That's the same appeal that a 99 cent or a dollar store has for the bargain hunter or the bargain seeker. And there's a lot of people out there who are really bargain seekers, who are value consumers, who want to get the deal.
Valerie Folks is a marketing professor at USC.
I better leave before I start buying things because I see a lot of bargains.
We've got pictures of some of my dollar store finds, good and bad, on our website, marketplacemoney.org. And while you're there, let us know what you think about dollar store shopping. If you go, if you don't go, what you buy, and what you would never touch. keep going on our Consume series, looking at all the reasons we spend the way we do. And Marketplace reporter Scott Tong checked out why we spend so much on our kids and why it can cost so much to give them a leg up. He joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Adrian. So I want to start by asking you a question.
Go ahead.
Right. So word has it, you're a new mom.
I am.
And if you were like my wife and me, when you shop for baby Asa, you bought the best something, right? Car seat or cradle or bottle or their front backpack. You went crazy on something, right?
I did. You know, we got a lot of stuff secondhand, but we did buy a pretty expensive car seat new because everyone said all the literature, all the government reports, buy a new car seat. So we went to Consumer Reports. We found the safest and we spent up on that one.
It's a must have.
Yes.
Right? I mean, there's this kind of parental blowing the budget impulse because it's our kid.
And we want them to be safe and happy and smart.
And then we want them to do well because right soon after they exit the womb, society starts to keep score. Right? Which baby talks first or walks first or can stack or kick with his or her left foot? And the reality is they're kind of competing to stand out really early.
What's that cost to get your kid ahead?
Well, I looked into this in a very middle-class suburb of D.C., Charles County, Maryland, a very diverse place, per capita income about $35,000, medium home value about $300,000, so really in the middle. And I met the Jackson family. They have three kids, 11 and 12 and 18, and they're all sports and music and academic stars. So here's the math of their wallet.
Okay.
Right. A season of elite baseball for an 11-year-old is
$2,000. $2,000?
U.S. dollars. And they travel a lot for tournaments. So every other weekend, they're staying in hotels. The two boys, the two younger ones, play clarinet. That's $100 a month. Everybody has an iPhone. That's $300 a month. And then there is sixth grader Connor Jackson's baseball bat. And I want you to guess how much a top-of-the-line Little League bat costs.
$50? $60? $70?
$179 for the baseball bat.
Yeah.
Let me play you a little tape of the parents, Lewis and Nikki Jackson, on why they paid for it.
You got to pay to play. You know, sometimes you do have to step up and buy a better baseball bat. It's a big difference from a $40, $50 bat. It's a big difference, man. Big difference.
The funny story is I went in the store. He told me the price after I fainted. I got up and I made the purchase. And I get home and I tell Lewis. And Lewis says, you know what? I don't care how much the bat was. Every penny spent is well spent.
Now, how are they paying for all this? I mean, this adds up to a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's perhaps multiple car payments per month. There's a few different ways to look at the cost. The dad, Lewis Jackson, works as a facility supervisor. Now, neither parent went to college, and he's done very well. He makes $77,000. He's kind of moved up to this middle-class life in Charles County and wants his kids to stay there. So he goes to work. He leaves the house at 4:30 in the morning so he can do his job and get home for the activities. So he pays in his time, and he pays in his money. And they pay out of their savings.
Wow. Their
oldest daughter got a full ride scholarship to college. But if the two boys don't get one, they're going to have to borrow or, you know, they're not saving enough for that. Who knows if they're saving enough for their retirement. And if you kind of look society-wide, there's a new study about all this keeping up. The folks at the University of Chicago call it trickle-down consumption. And that is, folks in the middle are spending so much to compete against everyone else, including the very rich, who are so far ahead of a lot of us. And what happens to people in the middle is they save less and they borrow more. And that is kind of the cost of this parental arms race.
So, I mean, can you step out and just say, no, I'm not going to buy the $179 bat? Or are these, do they make sense? Are they good investments?
Think of it this way. It is an economically rational thing, arguably. Right, we all want our kids to get into college.
Right.
So it's a lot of people chasing not too many slots. And so the more activities, the more tutors, right, the fuller your resume is, the better the chance it is that you're going to get into college. And you have to pay to play to do some of these things. So, you know, it's not just envy. This is something that's kind of rational, that you could get a return on your investment. That's the defense of this. But for society, you know, if everyone joins this arms race and spends, it's arguably a waste of money.
If everyone has the $179 bat, no kid's going to stand out.
Well, that's right. They all hit it to the same spot,
right?
Or everyone boosts their kid, which means no one has really moved ahead in the order, right? Nobody's a better hitter. All they've done is they spend a whole lot of money. And that's the argument that this is a waste of society's resources.
Marketplace reporter Scott Tong, thanks so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
So when do those additional investments in kids make sense, and when do they not? We've got Diane Lim with us now. You might know her from the show as well as her blog, Economist Mom. Hi, Diane.
Hey, Adrian.
So we just finished a conversation about the ways parents stretch and spend to try to get their kids ahead, to get their kids into college. Is it spending that makes any sense?
Well, I am very experienced at spending lots of money on my kids. That's for sure. I am an expert. But my overriding philosophy has always been that I want to make available to them the opportunity to try lots of things and to figure out not just what they're good at, but what they really like to do. You know, it's hard for parents to do this, but I try to not set my own expectations of where I want to see them go, and to try to just give them as much opportunity to set their own goals and find their own passions. Because I really do believe that cliche is true, that if you do what you love, the money will follow, simply because I'm convinced that each of my kids is going to be really good at whatever they find that they love to do.
And how much of the spending that you and your family do on your kids for these extracurriculars is really about helping them stand out from the crowd and maybe get into a great college?
I'm actually not a parent who has sort of forced my kids to do community service or whatever I think would look good on a college application. I've tried to instill upon them a sense of budget constraints, in that you can't do everything financially or time-wise. If you decide you really want to make a push for getting a really high SAT score, I would pay for any tutoring that the kids thought was helpful. But I have to tell you, my oldest two girls who are in college right now, neither of them ever went to an SAT tutor. And my oldest, in fact, I literally bought a paperback SAT study guide for her off of Amazon, and that is the only thing she did to practice.
So I'm going to ask you to put your economist hat on here and tell me, when parents think about spending to get their kids ahead or to get their kids in college, what are the pitfalls that they fall into?
There's a tendency for all of us to just throw money at anything that we think is going to have some small marginal effect on their chances of getting into a good school. We have a tendency to do a sort of flawed form of cost-benefit analysis. We ask ourselves, is there any chance that this thing that I could pay for would have some small positive effect on the outcome for my kid? And then the second question, instead of saying, and how does that amount of benefit compare to the amount of cost, mm-hmm. is we just ask ourselves, do I have the money in the bank to afford this? So when it comes to decisions about spending money for our kids, I find that I, at least, often forget to do the balancing of benefits against costs. And I just look for any positive benefit and say, if I've got the money to do it, I'll do it.
It's worth the cost. That's interesting.
It's worth, like, it's almost like saying that cost is no object for our kids, as long as there's some benefit and we have the money. It's sort of like how people shop for health care. When there's an issue of, having to spend a lot of money at the end of a loved one's life, I think that people with loved ones go through that same calculation, which is just, is there any chance that this provides some small amount of relief for their pain or suffering at the end? And if there is, it doesn't matter how much it costs. As long as I have the money in the bank, I'm going to pay for it.
No, it sounds kind of cruel, though, right, to sort of add that cost-benefit analysis when you're talking about a dying person or when you're talking about your kid's future.
It does, but when you think about the fact that if we just ignore the cost side of it, we're squeezing out something else in our life, right? I mean, mm-hmm. the reason why parents have to somehow try to get a grip on the cost side of that equation, that calculation, is because there will be bills coming due every moment. There are future expenses to pay for, and it just may not make sense. You may need that money much more to be able to pay for college costs than to get your kid ready with the SAT score to get into the college.
Diane Lim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, getting our kids into college is really what a lot of this spending is about, maybe even grabbing that elusive scholarship. And kids who have honed skills and developed talents in expensive classes might have an edge in this race to the top. But there's another tried and tested approach to getting that acceptance letter, and that's acing the college application essay. Back in January, we talked to Ron Lieber about his search for what makes a standout essay. He's the Your Money columnist for the New York Times and joins us now. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
So it's been 5 months since we last talked to you and heard about your call for college essays. How'd it go?
It went better than we could have dared hoped. You know, we just didn't know how many essays were going to come over the transom, but we ended up getting somewhere between 65 and 70, and many of them were actually really good.
What were kids writing about? What were they saying?
Well, one of the things that was surprising was that there were a lot of essays about work. And it wasn't so much about the parents' work or lack thereof and unemployment. Many of the essays were actually about kids' attempt to get work and how hard it is to be a teenager who wants a job but can't necessarily find one and may have to invent one in order to make money.
What made the essays that you did pick stand out?
I think the thing that they all had in common was that a number of them took real risks. The one essay that we picked that was really good was by a guy named Julian Cranberg, who lives outside of Boston. And he wrote about the sort of ridiculousness of all of the paper that was littering his house, all of the money that colleges were spending on marketing themselves to him. And he didn't really feel like that was appropriate. He actually added it all up, and it was something on the order of $200 in postage that various colleges had spent chasing after him,
wow,
including a DHL envelope, you know, labeled priority on the outside. And then he opened it up and it said, Julian Cranberg, you are a priority to us.
Now, did he get into the college he wanted to with that essay?
Well, that essay he actually sent to Antioch, and he did get into Antioch, but he also got into Oberlin, also in Ohio, and he decided that he wanted to go there instead.
Were there other essays that stood out to you?
There was one by a woman named Shanti Kumar, a young woman who goes to Bronx Science in New York City. She wrote an essay for Princeton, and the very first line of the essay was, I wonder if Princeton should be poorer.
What's that mean?
Well, what it meant to her was that, you know, she was being asked to respond to this whole idea of Princeton existing, you know, sort of for or in the nation's service. And she wondered, you know, given the size of its endowment, whether it was doing enough to exist in the nation's service and the world's service. And she used that as sort of a segue into a story about a cousin of hers in India who had died at a very early age from an illness that, you know, probably could have been prevented or cured had she not been living in a developing area of a developing country. And she sort of brought that all back to, you know, her desire to do good in the world and whether Princeton was doing enough good in the world itself. And it was, you know, incredibly daring, really effective, an incredible opening line that sort of stopped me and the other person who was reading it with me, Harry Bold, who was a longtime English teacher at the Horace Mann School, stopped us both cold. I mean, we really loved that essay.
And did she get into Princeton?
She did not get into Princeton. She's going to Cornell. I called Princeton for comment, and they wanted nothing to do with it. So, you know, we still don't know what they thought of her essay.
Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times. Thanks, Ron.
Thanks for having me.
This weekend is Father's Day. And what better way to celebrate than a little heart-to-heart talk about personal finance? Yeah, okay, there are probably other really good ways to celebrate. I'm sure my dad could come up with a few. But this is a sweet option. Tom Corley is a CPA based in Rahway, New Jersey. He's also author of the book Rich Habits, and he wrote this letter to his son, Brendan.
Hi, Bren. I've been meaning to talk to you about saving and budgeting since you moved out of the house and moved into your first apartment. I wanted to give you some financial advice that I wish my dad had given me when I was your age. So here goes. Make sure you set aside 20% of your net pay and learn to live off the 80% that's left. This forces you to live below your means, and living below your means is one of the keys to financial success in life. I want you to do this even if you start to get bonuses and raises. It doesn't matter. Set aside 20% of your net pay no matter how much money you make. I also want you to watch what you spend every day. Don't spend more than 25% of your net pay on housing. And don't spend more than 10% of your net pay on entertainment. Bren, I know you're Irish, and I know you like bars, just like me, but this is an important rule. Stick to the 10%. Don't spend more than 5% of your net pay on auto loans, and never lease. Leasing is what I call a poverty habit. Buy your cars and take really good care of them. Stay away from credit card debt. Credit card debt will get you in a lot of trouble. If you have to use credit card debt, that's a warning sign. It means you're living beyond your means, and you need to cut back on something. One last point I want to make, Bren. Most of the wealthy, they don't make a lot of money, but they do save a lot of money. I want you to focus on accumulating wealth, and if you get that big payday one day, that's just great. It's icing on the cake. Accumulating wealth is not about hitting it out of the park. It's about getting singles. You get enough singles, and you win the game. I love you very much, Bren, and I want you to be happy and successful in life. Good luck.
We're celebrating dads all weekend long on Marketplace Money. Even if your father isn't a CPA like Tom Corley, we're willing to bet he has some financial wisdom worth sharing. Tweet us at Radio Piggy Bank and be sure to use the hashtag Dad's Money Advice. And if you forgot about Father's Day altogether, maybe an e-greeting for Dad will save you in a pinch. A few weeks back, we asked listeners to submit their ideas for a personal finance greeting card. And we've got a winner, Jerry DeWitt, who tweeted this greeting. Forget about making ends meet. I can't even get them close enough to recognize each other. Jerry, you scored a Marketplace Money piggy bank and a copy of Man vs. Markets by our in-house personal finance guru, Patty Hirsch. Congratulations, Jerry. And that'll do it for Marketplace Money this week. Let us know what you think of the show at marketplacemoney.org. Or you can get in touch on our Facebook page and keep up with the show on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Lindsay Foster Thomas, Daryl Perinata, and Devin Maverick Robbins. Brendan Willard is our engineer. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is JJ Yore, and I'm Adrienne Hill. I hope you have a great weekend. This is APM.